More people learn all the time where food comes from before it gets to a grocery store. The fact is, things we can eat grow in abundance in many places, even on the streets and sidewalks in urban areas. Wild edible greens became a focus for a group of researchers in the San Francisco Bay Area. The greens grow in places where there's a need for people to find quality nutrition at a low cost. So the researchers looked at what grew naturally and what nutrition and safety it offered. We're joined by Philip Stark, professor of statistics at the University of California, Berkeley, listed as the lead author on the research. Philip, thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So when we're talking about greens, what kinds of greens are we talking about?
There's an enormous variety of leafy green vegetables that grow in urban environments and also agricultural environments and pretty much anywhere that people disturb the soil. Many of them have been traditional parts of human diet for tens of thousands of years, but have been marginalized as we've moved to a more industrial row cropping approach to agriculture. The plants that we were looking at in particular, we've mapped about roughly 130 species of edible plants in the Bay Area. The particular species that we were focusing on in our toxicity tests are things like dandelion and fennel and chickweed, dock, mallow, nasturtium. The vast majority of these are non-native invasive species from other continents.
Wow, the list is already longer than I would have expected. I figured dandelions for sure, but 130 species, that's a lot of stuff that grows out there that is edible and in some cases very good for us.
Indeed, they are. And 130 is not that long a list for a particular ecosystem. These are just things we've come across. And I want to emphasize that none of this is sort of discovering a new edible species. All of these species have been known to be edible for a long, 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 long time. And in fact, have been part of human diets traditionally and are still part of everyday diets on a lot of the globe, just not in our society.
So, Philip Stark, how did you get onto this issue? I noticed that your work can be very broad, from things like confidence in the Big Bang Theory to hearing loss in older people. So how did you get onto food in urban environments?
Well, it was a little bit of a long path. I'm a long-distance trail runner, and as I was running through beautiful scenic settings, started to get curious about the plants and what they're good for. And being good as food or medicine, of course, are two main uses for people. And once I started to recognize these species and stuff a little in my pockets on the way home to add to my dinner, your brain gets rewired and you start to see the plants everywhere. And I realize that they're not just growing in idyllic places, but are in fact growing in inner urban environments. They're literally everywhere.
Was that a bit of a revelation to you to be, I assume driving to campus in Berkeley or something and saying, hey, wait a minute, that's the stuff I see up in the mountains?
It kind of was. Berkeley itself is pretty green, and a lot of people don't meticulously manicure their lawns. Things tend to be a little more English garden style around here. So there's a lot volunteering. And I really started to see this biodiverse, mass of stuff as being far more interesting and rich than what we usually associate with, a well-manicured yard. And now when I start to, when I go through neighborhoods, lawns to me look sterile, and the more kind of tumultuous, verdant stuff looks to me, rich and delicious. Another interesting thing is the vast majority of the edible weeds in our area are non-native invasive species, as I mentioned. They really have traveled the world largely with agriculture. And as a result of that, pretty much anywhere you go on the planet, if you're in a roughly comparable climate, you'll see very, very similar plants. So I see much the same thing in Japan and Australia and Mexico and Norway and Belgium. Literally all over the world, you see, if you know a couple of dozen species, you'll be able to feed yourself.
Wow. We were talking to Philip Stark, professor of statistics at the University of California, Berkeley, about research he and three other people did into wild greens growing up in urban areas. Their publication from January of this year is called Open Source Food, Nutrition, Toxicology, and Availability of Wild Edible Greens in the East Bay. Questions, comments from you, welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We're still trying to raise Daphne Miller, one of your co-researchers from the School of Public Health at UC Berkeley, not getting through on her voicemail line. But you and she are part of the Berkeley Open Source Food Project, is that right?
Yes, she sends her apologies. She has the flu this morning.
Oh, okay.
I'm afraid you're not going to be able to reach her.
Okay, thank you for relaying that.
Not at all. I'm sorry, I missed the question.
Berkeley Open Source Food Project, tell us about that.
Well, it grew out of this idea that food really should be part of the human commons, and bristling a bit at the idea that a corporation can have intellectual property rights in food through GMOs or CRISPR or whatever. I think that our food supply really should be open to everyone. And indeed, these plants that we're studying in particular have been part of the intellectual commons and the food commons for millennia. So that's really trying to open this up to make sure everyone has the knowledge and information to be able to feed themselves, trying to improve food security and access and sustainability throughout the food system.
So, you went and looked, obviously, for the greens. Did you find that people had been picking the greens and using them for food?
Not in the neighborhoods where we were working specifically, although we did meet some people who had friends or relatives who were foraging not that far away. The communities that forage actively in the U.S. are largely ethnic groups that have brought the practice with them from elsewhere, be it Central America, Southeast Asia, India, and so on. There's also, of course, a bit of a cult around foraging in cuisine that I'm sure you're experiencing as well where you are,
yep.
Where you see more and more edible weeds on menus and unusual things that you can't get at the grocery store. There seems to be a pretty big divide between those two. And then there's a fraction of the population that forages for economic reasons, either to provide themselves with food at nutritious food at low cost, or to forage ingredients to provide to restaurants or others and literally make money doing it.
So I noticed you picked three sites in the study in the East Bay area. Give us some description of what kinds of things you found and what the environments around them were like.
Oh, goodness. Two of the sites were chosen deliberately because we expected the soil to be challenged with contaminants. One of them is in West Oakland, in an area that used to be a shipyard and is now mixed-use industrial and residential. So we were expecting a fair amount of toxic metals in the soil, possibly PCBs or other things that could render what would otherwise be delicious, nutritious food unsafe to eat. Another area is in Richmond, California. It's wedged between two major roads. We were expecting that everything from tire rubber to old lead from leaded gas to who knows what might be an issue in that area. The third area is a residential area in Berkeley, which we chose because it was the closest thing it was one of the furthest spots from where you could buy fresh produce in Berkeley. It's hard to get too terribly far away from a grocery store here, but in neighboring communities you can't. So that was chosen more for convenience. The site that we ended up focusing on, so we tested the soils in all three places and tested some dried plant tissue for heavy metals like lead, cadmium, nickel, and so on. And then ended up really focusing on the site in West Oakland, which had the most challenged soils. It had the highest levels of lead and other things, and went back to take tissue samples there of a greater variety of plants and test the wet tissue rather than the dried tissue, and test it not just for metals, but also for herbicides, glyphosate in particular, PCBs, and so on.
Yeah, that sounds like it could be quite a stew. And then add to that the fact that you picked these up, I think, 2014, 2015, which was a drought period. And what did you find in the way of the shape of the plants in those conditions?
Well, in some places, they were really still thriving. There were almost entire square blocks covered in sweet fennel. And things like a wild radish was doing really, really well, which is the edible part of that is the leaves and the fruit kind of seed pods that they produce and the flowers and whatnot, not the below ground root bit. But there's a lot of delicious food. In some places, hundreds of servings per address. We decided to analyze things in terms of addresses, because thinking of if you were someone who lived there, what would be available to you in your yard or in front of your house?
And Go ahead.
One of the surprises was exactly what you mentioned, that even at the end of a record drought, there was still a substantial amount of food growing August, September, the hottest time of the year.
We're talking to Philip Stark at the University of California, Berkeley, about research into wild urban greens, edible greens growing in places in the East Bay. And as you heard, places that even have in the soil things like lead and cadmium and nickel and PCBs and glyphosate. These were things tested for. We'll find out in a second what showed up in the actual greens. Questions or comments from you, welcome at 800-838-3760 on the phone or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So found the stuff in the soil, it sounds like, but how about in the plants?
The species that we tested were all safe to eat after washing the dirt off of them. Ingesting the dirt is a problem, and one of the reasons that people are concerned about lead in soil is because kids will put it in their mouths. It's often less of a concern for plants grown in the soil. Generally, plants don't phytoaccumulate. They don't extract things from the ground that they don't need. There are exceptions to that. There are things that will pick up nastiness from the environment. Watercress is a good example of that. But by and large, they don't. And the particular species that we looked at, chickweed, dandelion, dock, mallow, nasturtium, and oxalis, were all safe to eat after rinsing.
So just underwater, a couple seconds of scrubbing, and you're good?
Just like you're making a salad.
Wow. That seems to be amazing. This would seem to be a great boost to nutrition potentially in urban areas, but there are some caveats that you lay out in the research. And what are those?
Well, there's a lot of caveats. I mean, these are only these species. Soil chemistry matters. The species matters. The amount of rain matters. It's a very, very complicated process that results in the accumulation or not of this stuff. That said, our results are consistent with what's been found elsewhere in the studies in Massachusetts, in Italy, in Germany. Generally, these things have the kind of vegetative parts of the plants have found not to be a particular problem. One of the things that would be really lovely to see is a municipality doing soil testing at every address to find out where it's safe to grow your own food and where it's safe to pick food that's already volunteering. Imagine a one-time parcel tax as a piece of public policy to try to improve food security.
So, you found that most of this stuff could be, it sounds like everything could be washed off, but so are there cases you think where there would be things that would grow up with the plants that could not be washed off? They're inside them too deeply?
Oh, absolutely. No. Some plants do accumulate nasty things. The closest we found to something that would be dangerous in large quantities was a wild lettuce that was accumulating cadmium, not to the point that it exceeded recommended limits, but getting near it. You would have had to eat a substantial amount, pounds a day of this stuff, and it's very, very bitter. It's not something you would want to eat very much of. This is not a general thing. Not every plant is safe to eat. In fact, some plants are used to bioremediate various elements in the environment, like lead. There's an Indian brassica, an Indian mustard that's used to try to extract lead from soil as a form of remediation if the lead in the soil is high. Typically, to get it to extract the lead, though, you need to do something to make the lead more bioavailable to the plant. You need to deprive it of other things that it likes, and so on. So right now, what we're seeing is at least So far, so good. I guess that's the best I can say.
So what recommendations would you have, first on a personal level, before we get to the policy level, about, you know, if people think, well, this sounds okay. I think I might want to collect some dandelions out of the sidewalk or something. What sorts of cautions would you provide before they take that up?
Well, first and foremost, make sure you know the species that you're looking at. There are things out there that will make you sick or kill you, and you want to make really sure of the identification. You probably already know some species. You might recognize dandelion or, you know, oxalis, sourgrass, or something like that. So you have the beginning of a green list that you can add to as you learn more species. Second, I would definitely recommend not foraging very close to a major roadway, just out of an abundance of caution. Even though we've done testing of plants that were growing near major roadways and didn't find an issue, it just stands to reason that you're better off further away. I stay away from asphalt in particular. I think it probably leaches a lot more nasty stuff into the soil than cement does. I would stay out of areas that are that you know get treated by an agency. For instance, the area around rails and are often, you know, sprayed with this or that. Areas along the edges of highways are often sprayed with something. Second or third caution would be legal. In most of the U.S., the only place you can legally forage is on property that you own. Municipal lands, federal lands, and whatnot, it's typically not legal to take anything. Berkeley's municipal code, you can't even take a dead twig. So that's important, not a safety issue, but a legal issue. If you don't know what's been done to the land, I would be concerned. If it's your own, you know, if it's in front of your own house, you know whether it's been sprayed with herbicides lately, and so on. That said, most of the herbicides that are out there are intended to target exactly these plants, broadleaf weeds. And so if you see these weeds there, either it was sprayed yesterday or it hasn't been sprayed in a while. And so the fact that they're there is almost an indication that that there's less to worry about on the herbicide side. Not sure what to tell you.
But obviously a lot of cautions here. Best if it's a place that you're familiar with, you've seen the activity on there and can vouch for what the treatment
Absolutely.
Has been. Just a couple seconds left, Philip. Next phase of research coming. Is there more work to be done here for you guys?
Well, I hope we can expand and test a greater variety of species in, you know, more places. The legwork is fun and interesting, and we've gotten a fair number of students involved over the years. Unfortunately, the laboratory tests, the chemical tests are expensive, and that right now is really the bottleneck, getting funding to do more testing.
Okay, well, more work certainly coming. It sounds like there has been similar work in other places. This research is called Open Source Food, Nutrition, Toxicology, and Availability of Wild Edible Greens in the East Bay, three sites that were chosen by this research team, led by Philip Stark, Department of Statistics, University of California, Berkeley. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.